From the Moon Broadcast Center at KPCC, this is The Frame. I'm John Horn. Yes, it is true. The cost of going to see live music is skyrocketing. We're going to tell you why. And Grammy-winning classical guitarist Sharon Isbin talks about how she became a child prodigy pretty much by accident.
My parents brought my brother for the interview, and as soon as he realized it was classical, he said, "No way, I want to be Elvis Presley." So he never took a lesson, and I volunteered to take his place.
And we remember Robert Frank, photographer and music video director. All that coming up on The Frame. If you've noticed that a night out with live music is getting really expensive these days, it's not just you. Bloomberg's Lucas Shaw wrote about why concerts are so pricey, and he joins me now. Hey, Lucas.
Hey, John. Good to be back.
So I went to buy tickets for Lana Del Rey at the Hollywood Bowl in a month. This is theoretical because I don't have this kind of money. And if you buy retail seats, the only ones left are between $750 and $300, something called platinum charity tickets. And resale seats are crazy. The very last row at the bowl is $175 a seat. If you want to be up close, it's going to set you back $2,000. Is that reflective of what's going on nationally, that prices are really skyrocketing?
Yeah, the average price of a ticket, and this is to the kind of the 100 most popular tours, that's what's measured by Pollstar, which is an industry research firm. So in the mid-90s, if you wanted to go see one of the 100 biggest tours, the average ticket would be $25, $26 in that range. This year, the average ticket price is $91. So that's triple, almost quadruple. And you could say, well, of course, prices to everything have gone up. That's true. But the prices of concert tickets have gone up more than twice the rate of inflation and have gone up more than a lot of other leisure activities like movie tickets.
So what is driving that price hike? And I want to make sure we're talking about the same thing. Is this retail price or resale price or a combination of both?
It's the retail price, but the resale is an important part of the equation. So there's sort of a confluence of factors at work here. One is that artists stop making as much money from their sales, from album sales, because CD sales fell off due to piracy and iTunes and all the factors a lot of people know. So that made them even more reliant on their touring business to make money. Another was that people just sensed there was more demand because, you know, there were sports franchises were sort of innovators, if you will, in raising the prices for live events. People were just willing to pay more for live, and they didn't really have an alternative because there is no substitute for that experience. And then one of the other factors is the resale market. So because there was this pent-up demand, you saw a lot of savvy scalpers employ different tactics to come in, buy a bunch of tickets at whatever the retail rate was, and then resell them for a lot more. Artists and ticket sellers got very upset because they felt like, hey, we're missing out on millions, if not billions, of dollars here. So they started fooling around with different prices and ways to try to kind of kill the arbitrage opportunity for those resale sites. And the fourth thing, which I want to bring up just because of that Lana Del Rey, the platinum thing that you mentioned, there has also been a move towards really premium packages. So artists charging extra for super fans, or frankly, for wealthy people who are just willing to pay more to be up close or to get their daughter a signed book from the artist. And so in addition to the kind of the most expensive retail ticket, let's say the most expensive retail ticket is like $250, there might also be a plan where an artist charges like $900 for something a little extra special.
Yeah, it goes a lot higher because I looked. If you wanted to go to the safari camping experience at Coachella this year, $10,000, well, a little bit less. I think once you throw in a parking pass, almost $10,000 a person. And I assume those VIP experiences are also skewing the numbers a little bit higher. But isn't this just basic economics, supply and demand? If people are complaining about it, doesn't it just mean that there are more people willing to pay than there aren't?
Yeah, look, the demand is there. The question is, is a certain type of fan being priced out? You know, I spoke with a few different fans of this one artist, Pink, who people may remember from kind of the early aughts. She was a big pop star, had a fused a little pop and hip hop. I found some Pink fans who, you know, were really diehard about her and helped contribute to this pop star who I think a lot of people had sort of forgotten about or not thought about a whole lot, being the number two touring artist in the world so far this year. And they were kind of complaining because, look, this woman I spoke with, Bex Paul, she's 32, she lives in London, has seen Pink on like 150 times in her life. And she and her girlfriend bought tickets to 17 different shows this year. They end up going to 11. And she's willing to show up to this show, you know, at 9 o'clock in the morning to make sure that she sits in the front row. But there would be a certain amount of VIP tickets that guaranteed those fans the best positioning, no matter how early she got there to try to angle for a good spot.
I think the other thing that's worth noting, too, is that once you get in the door, the price hikes are still crazy. A week ago, I went to go see the National at the Greek Theater. Great concert, but I bought a beer and a small cup of wine for my wife, and it was nearly $30. And if you want to buy a T-shirt or any kind of merch, that's going to set you back maybe another $100 or so. Has that been a spike as well in terms of what you're paying once you actually enter the venue?
Yeah, in just the past 4 years, Live Nation, which is the biggest concert promoter in the world, says that their average on-site spend per fan, which is essentially what you and your wife are spending, just as the artist is trying to make more from the tickets, the promoter wants to make more from you while you're there.
And when you buy a ticket, you not only buy the ticket, you pay for, I think, facility fee, handling fee, you know, ticket printing fee, email fee. I mean, the fees are also pretty high. Has there been any kind of investigation or litigation over the ticket pricing and whether or not this has become monopolistic?
You know, there are calls for regulation and investigation all the time because Live Nation, which is the biggest concert promoter, bought many years ago Ticketmaster, which is the biggest ticket seller, and they also operate a very robust artist management company. And it would seem like that's a lot of power concentrated in one company. And so there were some calls by some members of Congress last week suggesting that the administration look into this company. But so far, for all the talk about it, nothing has really stuck, which is sort of funny. Look, you talk to people in the industry, and they have this sort of resigned attitude, which is like, this company is basically a monopoly and nobody cares and nobody pays that much attention to it and nothing is going to be done about it.
Lucas Shaw covers entertainment and media at Bloomberg. Lucas, always great to have you on the show.
Thanks, John.
Coming up, how Sharon Isbin mastered the classical guitar with a little help from transcendental meditation. Welcome back to The Frame. I'm John Horn. The music you're hearing now is by classical guitarist Sharon Isbin. A multiple Grammy winner, she's been performing professionally since the 1970s when she was only a teenager. Isbin studied with many masters of classical guitar, including the legendary Andre Segovia. She later established the classical guitar program at the Juilliard School. That's where she currently teaches. We discussed her career and her latest project yesterday from a studio in Chicago.
Hi there. Can you hear me? It's Sharon.
I can hear you. How are you?
Super. Thank you so much for taking the time.
Isbin is currently touring her new album. It's called Souvenirs of Spain and Italy. It's a collaboration with the Pacifica Quartet. And we started with the first time that she ever took a guitar lesson.
I, first of all, was an accidental guitarist, and I was 9 years old when our family moved to Italy for a year, and my older brother asked for lessons, and my parents got excited when they learned there was a student of Segovia who was touring in Italy and brought my brother for the interview. And as soon as he realized it was classical, he said, "No way, I want to be Elvis Presley." So he never took a lesson, and I volunteered to take his place, and that's how it all started. But when I was 16, my teacher left on sabbatical, so I was kind of on my own at that point, and I ended up using a mirror and a tape recorder.
And finally, the winner. She's 18. Ladies and gentlemen, Sharon Isbin.
I wonder if that period in your education where you were essentially kind of teaching yourself helped you develop your own voice, that you're becoming your own artist and not trying to emulate somebody else.
That's really true, and it also has guided me as a teacher to really give my students a lot of room and freedom. Of course, I give them guidance, But it's never a situation where I want clones or copycats, but I teach them about nuances and techniques and how to do that. And one of the hardest things for guitarists seems to be both rhythm and lyricism. So that often is a focus.
Is it their problem because they think that they can't do it?
No, it's really very simple. I think that when you're another instrumentalist or singer, you're used to playing with other people. But guitarists are used to spending a lot of time by themselves. So if their rhythm is a little off, there's no one there to tell them that.
And are you teaching now, or are you on leave this semester?
I haven't actually taken a leave ever from Juilliard, and this is my 30th year teaching here. But I leave a lot, so let's interpret the word leave.
Okay.
They give me the complete freedom to travel. I go on tour often. I'm right now speaking to you from Chicago, where I performed with the Pacifico Quartet, and the first 4 months of 2019, I made 3 albums in 4 months. I traveled on tour to India with amazing musicians who are virtuosos of the sarod, Amjad Ali Khan, who composed music for me to perform with him and his 2 brilliant sons. We just made an album that'll come out sometime in 2020. I did another album featuring, as the highlight, a new concerto composed for me by Chris Brubeck, who pays homage to his father, Dave Brubeck. So I get to leave a lot, but not take a leave.
I want to ask you about a piece on your new album. It's Quintet for Guitar and String Quartet. It's by the Italian composer Mario Castelnuovo Tedesco. And I heard that you actually had a chance to meet with one of the composer's grandchildren. Is that right?
I discovered that several months before the recording that Diana Castelnuovo Tedesco lives just a few blocks from me in New York City. So we met up, and she regaled me with these fabulous stories about her grandfather Mario, and also gave me a copy of his handwritten manuscript of the quintet, which he had written for Segovia in 1950. So to be able to consult his handwriting of the notes every day in the process of learning the piece and putting it all together was really very, very special. I felt like Mario was sitting there with us, and I felt like, in a way, part of the family. To learn about his history, the fact that his family originally came from Spain and had to flee in 1492 from the Grand Inquisition. They settled in Italy and then had to flee the Nazis in the late 30s to save their lives and landed as refugees in the United States in California. And by that point, beforehand, Mario and Segovia had already become good friends, and Mario was composing music for him. This particular quintet was written in 1950, and it certainly, you can hear how it draws on the Spanish influences of his background. In fact, in the second movement, he writes Souvenir of Spain, and that gave us the idea of the title for this album. But what was so special is to know that he considered it, quote, one of his best works for chamber music that he'd ever written. And it's rarely performed and rarely recorded because it's so demanding. So it is a work that I'm glad we had a chance to rehearse at length and perform at length before we actually made the recording.
Well, it hasn't been recorded very much, but we did find an earlier recording of it, and that is played by Andres Segovia. That's Segovia. Now let's listen to you. If you listen closely, there are certainly differences. How would you say your interpretation is your own?
Any performer really draws from their own experience and their own way of feeling the music. And of course, that is always in a combination with looking at the markings on the score. That was another thing about having the manuscript. It's filled with dynamic markings, all kinds of hairpins and pianos and fortes. And if you really follow that, it's revelatory. And I add different colors and find ways of expressing what can be done on the guitar with what we call portamento, which is a shift from the one finger to another in the left hand to create that vocal cry.
We're talking with guitarist Sharon Isbin about her new record, Souvenirs of Spain and Italy. There is a piece on the album by Joaquin Turina. It's called The Bullfighter's Prayer. It's about a bullfighter who is mentally preparing to enter the ring. And I'm wondering if that kind of mentality is something that you think about when you're going out to play and about being prepared and about getting yourself ready to perform.
Well, certainly preparing is important. I've practiced transcendental meditation ever since I was 17 years old, so I do that twice a day. It's a very simple technique of stress release and inner focus and mental stamina preparation that's as easy as sleep, but it's a very different process and one that has tremendous physical benefits. It even lengthens your telomeres, so it helps to maintain a youthful physical appearance, because that's one of the keys of eternal youth is lengthened telomeres. So go for it for whatever reasons you want, but it is a great way of, as being a musician, to access my own creativity that I can really express.
We talked a little bit about Tedesco, who fled Italy before World War II, and another composer on this album, Turina, also fought against fascism in his native Spain under Franco. As an artist, does the history of these composers change the way that you see their pieces or think about why they're important to present to audiences?
Absolutely. I mean, when you look at Mario Castelnuovo Tedesco's smiling face and you think how many millions like him were slaughtered by the Nazis, it makes you sick. And it makes you think how fortunate he was to be part of our world and to have given us such an incredible legacy. And we have to be so mindful of being respectful and supportive. I mean, we're all in this together.
It feels like in recent weeks, especially with a story out of LA Opera about Plácido Domingo, we're learning more about how perilous it can be to be a woman in the classical music world. How do you start talking to students about the risks? And how do you think the classical world is going to become more accountable? Because it feels like there may be even more problems than we have heard of already.
Oh, it's been around for decades and probably centuries. You have to be so respectful of the student's own inner integrity and sanctuary. And, you know, people like Plácido Domingo and Bill Prussell and others, their behavior is indefensible. It's just inexcusable. And let me just say, applause is no vindication for bad behavior. And when someone is abusing the right of women to have a safe workspace and a safe study place, they need to go out the window.
Sharon Isbin's new record is called Souvenirs of Spain and Italy. Sharon, thanks so much for coming on the show.
It's my pleasure. Thank you so much for taking the time.
Up next on The Frame, we remember the photographer, Robert Frank. I'm John Horn, and this is The Frame. Robert Frank, one of the most important and influential photographers in 20th century America, died Monday at the age of 94. Frank was born in Switzerland, but his body of work focused on ordinary Americans doing ordinary things, going to work, eating, walking, shopping. His 1959 book, The Americans, grew out of his crisscrossing the country with a camera. He was also the subject of the 2015 documentary, Don't Blink, Robert Frank. It was directed by Laura Israel, and I reached her by Skype this morning, and she told me how they met.
A lot of people don't know that, but he did a music video for the band New Order back in 1989. A friend of mine was the producer for a lot of New Order videos, Michael Schamberg. So he introduced the two of us. And The first time I met him, it was amazing. He came in and we looked at some of the footage, and we were making selects. And back in those days, it was videotape, so you had to rewind and fast forward. So it was very important to pick like good shots so you wouldn't have to go back. And I just turned to him and I said, you're going to want to go back and look over this stuff at all? Because I'll prepare for that. And he said, no, it's fate. A first thought, best thought. And I thought, I really like this guy right away, you know.
So let's step back and talk about Robert Frank's work. And it's, you know, there's a lot to digest, but what would you say really set him apart, and why was he so influential?
Well, of course, The Americans was the big start for him. And I think one of the things that he says in Don't Blink, the film that I did about him, is he says that he worked really hard. He really got up in the morning and went out all day, really searching for situations and people where he could really get an idea of Americans. And I think that that's something I really felt from him.
And yet he was such an invisible presence as a photographer. It felt like he was observing life the way you would observe it walking down the street and seeing people yourself.
That was his thing. And I think for him, it was harder. He said it was a challenge to get close enough to people while doing that. But that was really important to him, to really show someone at their truest moment. And he did say when they noticed they were getting their picture taken, it wasn't as good after that. If you look at his contact sheets, which we did, you can see the series of photos. And then as soon as they realized they were getting their picture taken, they would smile or act phony, you know. But right before that, you would see this something in their eyes that would just be very telling.
How would you describe the way that the things that were important to him as a person intersected with the things that were important for him to photograph?
They were one and the same, really, honestly. You know, during The Americans, he photographed people without them knowing it, and he would barely talk to them, and he wouldn't get to know them. But as he got older, he started to photograph a lot of his friends, and they were more friendly pictures and photographs of people that he knew. That became really important to him. So I think it's kind of interesting that that changed over time.
Was he a willing participant in your documentary? Because the footage I've seen, even in your film, it's fair to say he wanted his work to speak for itself and was somewhat uncomfortable on camera.
I can't stand it, you know, to be pinned in front of a camera, because I do that to people. I don't want it to be done to me.
It was even weirder for the two of us because I had been sitting next to him for so long without, you know, grilling him or putting a camera on him. So it was a much different relationship. So I sort of had to change my persona as well. The thing is that I think he was at a point where he really wanted to talk about things. And I kind of clued into that.
He also had a strong relationship with beat poets, especially Jack Kerouac, who narrated a film Frank directed called Pull My Daisy. How would you describe his relationship with beat poets?
He really admired them. He couldn't be like them. He was, somebody coming from Switzerland, which is this sort of really, it's a much different culture than the beat poets. So he sort of felt inspired by that. And he was also interested in poetry and music and painting.
Robert Frank either worked alongside or preceded some remarkable American photographers. I think of people like Danny Lyon, Mary Ellen Mark, Elliot Erwitt, Lee Friedlander, Helen Levitt, W. Gene Smith. How would you describe his legacy and the way that he influenced the way that photographers changed throughout the 20th century?
Photographers really felt a freedom from Robert. I think he kind of figured out how to break the rules before they had even thought about it. And I think that he really freed up the composition and the way you look at photography. I mean, he changed the genre. I think he really inspired a lot of people to break the rules.
And what did you learn yourself as an artist from being around him and looking at his work? How did he change you?
Well, I'd have to say that first day when I met him is something I still think about today. Really, first thought, best thought, and to really just go with your gut, go with what you're thinking. Don't think twice about anything. The other thing that really inspires me is his relationship with his wife, June Leaf, and how both of them are so devoted to work constantly. I mean, every time I saw them, they would be working or talking about work or looking at something. So I found them really inspiring.
Well, he died Monday at the age of 94, and it sounds like he pretty much died with his boots on, that he was still working very close to the time that he died.
I'm sure of it.
Laura Israel is a filmmaker and the director of the 2015 documentary Don't Blink, Robert Frank. Laura, thank you so much for sharing your thoughts about Robert Frank on his passing.
And thank you. I love to talk about my friend.
Don't Blink, Robert Frank is available on iTunes. I'm John Horn at the Moen Broadcast Center at KPCC. The Frame is back here tomorrow.